The Game Changer by Sheena Lester. Who'd veto that? I remember thinking immediately after someone in that fateful XXL meeting brought up a cover concept supposedly shot down before my arrival. A remake of Art Caine's iconic jazz portrait, one of the most renowned photographs in music and magazine history, reshot on its original site? That seemed too fantastic, and frankly too feasible an idea for the smart brothers who preceded me to reject. Maybe my years as editor-in-chief of Rat Pages had inured me to the idea of an impossible cover. Difficult? Sure. Impossible? Nope. There was nary a cover concept, no matter how odd or unlikely, that Rat Pages' wildly imaginative edit squad couldn't somehow massage into viability, then ultimately, reality. We snuck onto government land to shoot Goody Mob immersed in a dank pond where snakes swam almost as freely as fish. We talked Lauryn Hill into being slathered in sky blue body paint from her ears to her ankles. We even persuaded a lovely young model named Shonda Santiago to let Old Dirty Bastard cup her bare breasts to playfully kick Rolling Stone's infamous 1994 Janet Jackson cover in its shins. Gathering as many hip-hop artists we could on the same Harlem stoop, beloved jazz visionaries like Count Basie, Dizzy Gillespie, Thelonious Monk, Charles Mingus, Art Blakey, and their ingenious ilk once famously posed for Esquire? Hell, what was so hard about that? Granted, recreating Caine's seminal image wouldn't be easy, but so what? If there was ever a creative crew outside the Rat Pages squad that could do it, this was the one. Larry the Black Spot Hester had left Vibe with me to run XXL as the consummate lieutenant to my captain. We were clearly on a mission to tread some new and exciting territory. Everyone was. The skeletal staff at Slam, Harris Publications' wonderfully raw basketball magazine, had become its hip-hop cousin's editorial girders by default after its original leader's departure. The wise and wily Tony Gervino, shit-talker extraordinaire Scoop Jackson, razor-witted Russ Bengston, mercurial design man Don Morris, deadline regulator Anna Gebbie, and Ben Osborne, the young wonder twin opposite XXL's zealous Daytwan Thomas. The two are PAC's hungry, playful cubs, eager to learn and mature their protective elders' sides. It was spring of 1998, and XXL's inner circle found itself literally seated in one. No table between us, just notepads on laps and pens in hands. Just like at Rat Pages, XXL editorial meetings were, to me, every week's highlight. They, too, were exercises in productive engagement, used to not only plan and status check details of pending issues, but also connect and bond over the music and culture we were immersed in and inspired by. Open, honest dialogue was encouraged and expected, and positions didn't matter a bit. Interns' opinions were given equal weight as those of their titled supervisors. Spotting a skeptical lip curl or eyebrow raise from a junior staffer was always a treat for me at these sessions as convener, since those telltale giveaways were surefire opportunities to coax out a contrary viewpoint that'd inform or deepen our discussions, frequently both. Over time, as those players' confidence bulked up, the need to cajole out their insights disappeared, making for even richer in-the-huddle interchange. So here we were, talking about upcoming features to consider and highly anticipated albums for summer and fall. Once the subject of recreating the Art Caine photo interrupted the agenda, all else hit the back burner. But, surprisingly, this bright bunch needed to be convinced we can make it happen. Why not? What's stopping us? I shrugged in response, genuinely taken aback at their reluctance. It's not like Harlem is Mars. It's a couple miles up the street. Why can't we do it? Y'all are really going to have to explain it to me. Why can't we do it? Asked aloud, something about the question's fundamental simplicity must have started to shake the team's doubt from its foundation, indicated by the shift in their body language. Facial expressions morphed from outright disbelief to hopeful contemplation. Crossed arms loosened into slow shrugs of consideration. Eyes peered skyward as whirring prospects spun behind them like pinwheels, sly smiles widening out underneath. A barrage of queries and comments erupted. How would we decide who should be there? The original picture was taken when? It'd be an instant collector's item, wouldn't it? Could we bring in people to help? What if only East Coast artists show up? Having knocked the concept into the realm of possibility, we kicked it around amongst us for a while. Thankfully, it didn't take much effort to sway them. By the time we finished, their stubborn reservations had vanished, or at the very least, been outsized by some eagerly won certitude. Our meeting ended on a high, the fundamental vision firm, yet morphing with every impromptu conversation and brainstorm summit between us over the next couple of weeks. Once we discovered it was Jazz Portrait's 40th anniversary year, the die was cast. But instead of planning the shoot for a random month's cover, it was slotted for year end. As expected, Dennis Page, the magazine's publisher, was an easy sell, even on hiring an outside firm to manage the whole thing. A Trenton, New Jersey guy with a love of black music deeper than well water, Dennis was no stranger to Kane's photo or its significance. He loved everything about the recreation idea from the door, even when originally proposed by executive publisher Jonathan Rheingold at the suggestion of his wife, Pamela, as XXL's launch cover image. But Dennis was the man holding its wallet, so he knew more than the rest of us the crucial need to position ours, branded hip-hop on a higher level, as a standout from all the other urban zines on newsstands. The timing, he'd surmised, had to be right. 7 issues in, it was. We sketched out a rough framework from which to launch, an open call for every artist or figure, old school and new, indie soldiers and major label chart dwellers alike, who'd made an unquestionably noteworthy impact on hip-hop music and its progress, or had ever recorded a rap album. That spared us the drama and trauma of having to comb through a miles-long roster of deserving DJs, B-boys, B-girls, and graph writers across the country who'd made immeasurable contributions to hip-hop. We'd stick to those who made records. Naturally, we'd ask the inventors and originators to be there, but we'd hit every signed act we could reach too, hoping that if they were familiar with Kane's famous Esquire photo, or their publicist was, and believed it worthy of a hip-hop remix, they'd get the concept, get themselves to the shoot site, and get on XXL's cover. We only needed 57 people to match the number of jazz masters in Kane's image, so if even a smidgen of those we invited showed up, that'd be a feat. Now, who to help us pull it off? Had to be someone who'd know the artist to target and how to reach them without any hand-holding from an already deadline-dazed staff. I gave Dennis the contact info for Leslie Pitts, the fierce, widely adored publicist who'd been a force of nature at Set to Run, Layla Turcan's standard-setting PR house and hotbed of black music publicity talent, then served as Jive Records' vice president of publicity before finally stepping out and starting her own company, No Screaming Media. Leslie's collaborator would be the equally formidable Biff Warren, a veteran publicist I'd met years prior during his stint at Palace Records. He'd handled press for a mix of underground rap grimies and A-list R&B phonies for years, so Biff had the trust of cats on Brooklyn's back streets and in lush high-rise suites. Their combined acumen guaranteed that our ambitious project would be in capable hands. Plus, as an added bonus, any time spent toiling aside these two was just as sure to be a hoot, even amid the stress. Once contracted and officially on the clock, Leslie, Biff, and I took the 6 train uptown to further scope out the block of 126th Street between Madison and Fifth Avenues. A handful of us from XXL had already swung by the site address, which was 17 East 126th Street, so we three went in search of the closest nearby church that could act as our outpost, a place with a decent-sized community space where the invitees could post up before and afterward with some catered food, probably from the nearby Sylvia's. As luck would have it, the massive Metropolitan Community Methodist Church sat right on the northeast corner of 126th in Madison, where a sweet woman named Denise Pickett greeted us with warm hugs. She let us tour their huge second-floor multipurpose room and made arrangements for Les and Biff to connect with its pastor to talk specifics. As we were leaving, talk turned to security, and it was unanimously agreed, maybe even suggested in unison, the Nation of Islam. Boom. Leslie's call a few days later flipped our entire script. She had a suggestion from her longtime love, writer Michael Gonzalez, a close personal pal and professional favorite of mine since the Rap Pages days. "You know who we should get to shoot the cover?" she gushed excitedly when I answered. No greeting, nothing. "Who, girl?" We'd been contemplating some candidates, mainly photographers who'd already shot covers for us. Tragically, Kane himself, who was among our initial brainstorm considerations, had committed suicide in 1995. "Gordon Parks." "Of course. Gordon Roger Alexander Buchanan Parks, the groundbreaking Life magazine photojournalist, the founding editorial director of Essence, the filmmaking pioneer who brought charismatic PI badass John Shaft to silver screen life, carving an unabashed black swagger boss relief onto the world's cinematic consciousness while simultaneously saving a borderline bankrupt Hollywood studio. Plus, so much of Parks' own story mirrored the culture itself. Like hip-hop, very few corners in Black America hadn't been somehow touched or shaped by his audacious brilliance. Like hip-hop, he was the ultimate insider to life's mainly white audience, his images serving as windows into worlds and secrets kept hidden, not by deliberate concealment or force, but by apathy and disinterest. He, too, was passionate, complicated, principled, flawed. And as wondrous galleries told tales of brutality and beauty with the same detail and nuance as hip-hop's starkest, most enigmatic verses. Even better, Parks had a rich, important history in Harlem, sealed by the moments he captured there. His close, storied friendship with Malcolm X began uptown after he followed the then NOI spokesman from 125th Street and 7th Avenue to a Muslim restaurant on Lenox. The fiery orator had just effectively dressed down a group of white NYPD officers standing on the periphery of a crowd of Black Harlemites enthralled by his eloquence. Parks was still being lauded some 5 decades after he pointed his camera at Red Jackson, the handsome, charismatic subject of 1948's Harlem Gang Leader, the centerpiece of his debut photo essay for Life. 20 years later, Parks put its readers face-to-face with Uptown's violent poverty via the haunting, revelatory A Harlem Family and his weeks living with perpetually jobless, frequently abusive, alcoholic Norman Fontenelle, Norman's beleaguered wife Bessie, and the youngest of their 8 children. His sharp, detailed examinations of heartbreak and exhaustion poignantly illustrated the strength and humanity of America's put-upon Black stepchildren with a depth and grace unseen before or since. With his fabled eye behind the lens, XXL's cover shoot would result in so much more than any of us envisioned. We'd no longer simply be remaking a classic picture to cap off our Best of 1998 coverage. This photograph would become an artifact in its best, most accurate sense, a masterwork that would join the universally celebrated canon of one of the nation's true cultural giants. Gordon Parks, he was better than perfect. He was a game changer. "Oh my God, Leslie, are you kidding me?" I replied hysterically after the mental backflip stopped. "That is fucking ingenious, Gordon Parks. He's exactly the right person. Oh my God, that's the best idea ever. You think he'll do it?" "I'll find a number for him," she countered excitedly, her usual optimism abounding. "All we can do is ask, right?" Harry Allen and I were arm in arm at the Museum of the City of New York about 2 weeks or so later, taking in, by bizarre coincidence, the Half Past Autumn, the Art of Gordon Parks exhibit, when my pager went off. It was Leslie's office number with a 911 for emergency at the end. Thankfully, no one was at the payphone near the entrance. "Hey girl, I got your page. What's up?" "Bad news," she groaned. "Gordon Parks said no." "Aw, damn. Really?" I was equally crushed. "Did he say why?" "His assistant said he wasn't interested," she said. "They probably field all kinds of requests to shoot some amazing things in some amazing places, so he can pick and choose. Guess he's not exactly in a hurry to shoot a bunch of rappers." "Shit, shit, shit." "So what now?" I asked her, deflated. Knowing that anyone among XXL's talented scrum of contributors could get the shot was zero consolation. After being so close to booking a demigod like Parks, they all felt like letdowns. "I think you should call him, Sheena, and get him to change his mind," Leslie said decisively. "Pull out those powers of persuasion." After a beat, she added with a giggle, "Put that sexy voice to some use." "Oh, that was funny. You're stupid." "No, seriously," Leslie said solemnly. "Call the man. If you want him to shoot this cover, you really do have to." Oh, I took a breath, both in resignation and to calm this fear suddenly seizing my insides. "I know. Fuck. Give me the number. If all else fails, I'll beg." "You ain't too proud," she joked. "Good luck, Mama." I wasn't even sure I had more change for the payphone. Found a couple quarters, thank heaven, so I dropped one into its slot and dialed the Parks Foundation while praying inwardly like a madwoman. Mr. Parks' assistant answered right away, as if she'd been on standby at Leslie's instruction. After the traditional niceties, she put the gentleman himself on the line.
Hello.
Mr. Parks, hello, I blurted, trying not to sound too gushy, especially challenging since I'd been standing 4 feet away from his prestigious handiwork just minutes ago. My name is Sheena Lester, and I'm the editor-in-chief of XXL Magazine. Thank you so much, sir, for taking the time to speak with me today. It's both an honor and a pleasure.
Shut the hell up and breathe, woman, screamed the voice in my head that's always obeyed.
The pleasure's all mine, miss. His voice was deep, gravelly, friendly, elegant, but no nonsense. I imagined him, Cap and Peterson pipe in hand, under a cloud of gray hair and smoke haze, standing beside a carved marble fireplace inside a luxe townhouse study, his own framed etchings dotting rows of antique mahogany shelves teeming with rare books and personal treasures. So, I began carefully, my associate tells me that you've turned down our request to take the cover photo for XXL's year-end issue.
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Parks retorted matter-of-factly.
Well, I can't tell you how disappointed I am to hear that, I told him, my nerves somehow eased by his directness. We were really hoping that because of its historic intent, how it pays homage to the generation of black genius that preceded this one, shooting this cover would be something that would appeal to you.
Come on, Mr. Parks, I pleaded inwardly. You get this. You embody black genius.
His subconscious must have heard mine. Explain to me again exactly what it entails, he insisted. My spiel was ready. We were assembling rap's finest for XXL, just as Art Kane had amassed the era's jazz titans for Esquire, in tribute to the young lensman, his illustrious subjects, and the object d'art created that summer morning 40 years prior. We were paying homage to hip-hop's musical godfathers by bringing their artistic progeny to the very same steps in Harlem those elders' presence had consecrated. We were making a statement about hip-hop's import and impact, how it, like the jazz music he so adored, expressed the indelible pain and hard-won progress endemic to the black experience that birthed it, all while being derided by an uptight audience that would eventually embrace it. And we were creating an artifact that would embrace and encapsulate what fulfilled promise looks like, personified however many times over, a family portrait that would connect each attendee and all who viewed slash experienced it to that moment, to each other, to hip-hop itself, like no other in existence. His hesitance was palpable. If only I had the authority to negotiate a higher fee, I'd have a backup fail-safe, or at minimum, an essential tool with which to negotiate. I didn't even know what we'd offer to pay the man.
No, was Mr. Park's resolute rejoinder. I'm sorry, miss. That doesn't sound like something I should shoot.
Damn, I thought before taking a deep breath, silently praying, please, ancestors, work with me. Into the receiver, though, went my only straightforward argument and enticement. Not facts, just truth. Well, Mr. Parks, I said, XXL could get any photographer to take the picture. Bryant Cross, Danny Hastings, Johnny Mannion, Carl Posey. Mentioning those names as a sort of subconscious assurance to him that hip-hop had cultivated its own masters of the medium he'd dominated since before any of them were born. But in all honesty, sir, we believe no one should take it but you. For every reason in the world that really matters, Mr. Parks, no other photographer should take this picture but you. Silence again. Another deep breath. Thankfully not mine this time.
What's your name again, young lady? Mr. Parks inquired gruffly.
Sheena Michelle Lester, sir, I replied, every muscle tensing like the crossed fingers on both my hands. Another pause. It felt like forever.
All right, Miss Lester, I'll do it.
I screamed right there in the museum. It was quick, not into the phone. The girl was excited, not insane, nor did it attract undue attention. Instead, eliciting a long baritone chuckle on the other end, and the quizzical look on Harry's face when I returned, steel reeling, to his side after signing off with Mr. Parks, calling an overjoyed Leslie, then my equally happy parents collect with the news. Leslie's delight, Mom and Dad's pride were thrilling, but it was while recalling the conversation's minutiae to my brother friend and watching his expressive countenance warm with each word that the reality of it all struck me. Gordon Parks said yes. The tale told, Harry grasped my shivering hands and held them tightly. We just stood there, still, quiet, our eyes locked, smiling till our faces were sore. The magnitude of our elation was indescribable, almost physical. It was as if in that split second, what the two of us came to understand had zapped our unsuspecting spirits like white-hot lightning bolts, and we wanted to feel its enormity course through our bodies like electric currents. For those few precious minutes, Harry and I reveled in the realization, something the world over would learn soon enough. Hip-hop, via this moment in hip-hop, really would be here forever. From the outset, XXL's cover event was labeled a great day in hip-hop as a way to double-dip on the tribute paying. Not only would Jazz Portrait get the love it so richly deserved as a singular photograph, but so would A Great Day in Harlem, the 1994 Oscar-nominated Quincy Jones-narrated documentary that caught Pam Rheingold's eye. Directed by Gene Bock, it captured the goings-on the August 12th morning of Kane's 1958 photo shoot, rooted in home movie footage shot by famed bassist Milt Hinton, his wife Mona, and recollections from some of the musicians who participated. Similarly, hip-hop now had an indisputable date with destiny just over four decades later, Tuesday, September 29, 1998. Mr. Park secured, Leslie and Biff's dual-engine publicity machines went into overdrive. They activated their direct relationships with indie and label publicists alike and their river-deep connections to a wide swath of hip-hop notables and industry blabbermouths to maximum effect. As weeks flew by, responses from artists and their reps rolled in just as rapidly. Among the early regrets, KRS-One was relocating out west. Ice Cube had unbreakable film commitments. TV commitments had ensnared Queen Latifah and LL Cool J. Public Enemy, of course, would be on a world tour. And neither Nas nor Snoop could alter prior plans. Still, confirmation calls kept No Screaming's phones abuzz. Busta Rhymes was in. So was Common and fellow Chi-Town representatives Crucial Conflict. Cool Herc. Ultramagnetic MCs. Scarface. Corrupt. Third Bass's MC Search. Heather B. Mobb Deep. 8-Ball and MJG. The Roots. The Fugees. The Fresh Prince? No. DJ Jazzy Jeff? Yes. The original Jazzy Jeff? Hell yes. Plus the other Funky Four. The Cali Kanye Shanti would be in full effect. MC8, Exhibit, The Alcoholics, Mac-10, DJ Muggs reppin' for Cypress Hill, Bay Area Royalty, E-40, Dell, the Funky Homo Sapien, Souls of Mischief and the Hieroglyphics Massive, Slick Rick, Joseph Run Simmons and his big brother Rush, Andre, Dr. Jekyll Harrell, Fab Five Freddy, Blondie's Debbie Harry and Chris Stein, Luther Campbell, Pete Rock, Daddy-O, De La Soul, Wu-Tang Clan's You Got an Inspector Deck, Fat Joe, A+, Ed O.G., Cannabis. Outkast and Jay-Z had albums dropping on the 29th, Aquemini and Volume 2 Hard Knock Life, respectively, so they'd be no-shows. Conversely, A Tribe Called Quest, Brand Nubian, and Black Star, releasing The Love Movement, Foundation, and Mos Def and Talib Kweli are Black Star LPs that day, affirmed they'd make it, as would Schoolie D, Angie B, Kool Moe Dee, Rakim. Not surprisingly, Les and Biff proved to be all that and more as project managers. They handled every detail of Great Day, from reaching out to major print, TV, and entertainment media outlets and handling the crush of local press requests, to obtaining the necessary city permits and renting a comfortable on-site trailer for Mr. Parks, whose involvement had rendered XXL's cover shoot virtually mandatory for any rapper worth their salt. Dennis and Jonathan were walking on sunshine next to the guys in sales. Over on our side, the entire edit staff fielded increased calls from colleagues and friends wondering if there was guestless onlooker love to be doled out. Not much, no, but we weren't pressed. We were all flying high. I crashed late one morning after a fuming Leslie called the office, practically spitting fire, angrier than I'd ever heard her. "You are not going to believe this," she seethed. "You're at your desk, right? Sitting down?" "Oh, Lord," I think. "Is the church trying to jack us for more money?" Not yet. This development was a slight more ungodly. Danielle is telling publicists at the labels that any of their artists who show up for Great Day in Hip Hop will be banned from Vibe. Huh? I bolted up in my chair. No, she's not, Leslie. Tell me you're joking. I'm not, she muttered testily. I wish I was. Can you believe it? Just like that, my instinct-led leap the year before to roll the dice at XXL had been validated. Vibe's former editor-in-chief, Alan Light, had lured me away from Rap Pages, intent on making his book more like our irreverent, edgy mix of hip-hop music and culture reporting, commentary, and whatnot. Upon Danielle Smith's appointment to the top job after her stint as music editor, she summoned me to lunch at ABC Carpet and Home, where she explained that as far as Vibe's music coverage was concerned, the plan on her watch was, quote, to follow the pop charts. The words echoed in my ears like church bells. Follow the pop charts? I sure as hell didn't leave Los Angeles' loving embrace or haul my pregnant with twins behind from the big chair at Rap Pages to track pop audiences' fickle whims. The masses are asses, remember? Our chat made it clear the vibe Danielle planned to create wasn't one I'd enjoy or thrive in. That was when I, as Large Professor so succinctly stated, started looking at the front door. But this time, shock instantly morphed into rage. She'd already brought Leslie some industrial strength hurt. Instead of being happy for the huge feather Great Day would put in the cap of her close friend's young business, Danielle stopped speaking to Les after No Screaming Partner with XXL. Plus, not only was this competition at its ugliest and most twisted, it was ineffectual. Because everybody, recognized that Mr. Parks' participation, his willingness to elevate this photo into his glorious portfolio, gave our shoot undeniable historic significance. It transcended magazine rivalry. The fact that she'd attempt to cow a single soul from taking part was as mystifying as it was infuriating. Needless to say, I was beyond infuriated. I'll call you right back, I hissed, slamming down the receiver before lifting it into a tight grip while furiously dialing the number of Vibe's chief executive officer, Keith Klinkscales. He had forgiven me long ago for persuading Blackspot to leave their ranks with me. Hey, lady, what's going on? Keith asked before I could utter a word, probably forewarned by his secretary that something was off in my usually friendly tone. Everything okay? Not at the moment, no, I replied flatly. A very reputable source just told us that Vibe's editor-in-chief, avoiding the taste of her name in my mouth, I was so disgusted, is threatening record company publicists, warning them that if their artist posed for XXL's Great Day in Hip Hop cover, the one being taken by Gordon Parks, they'll never be featured in your magazine again. You would know anything about this, would you? Wait, what? He sounded truly taken aback. I began again, teasing Leslie's claims apart slowly. Keith listened with Job's patience, saying nothing, but I suspected he'd be gobsmacked. One, this proud FAMU graduate would forfeit a thumb before intentionally blocking a lone black person, let alone dozens of black cultural pioneers, from being captured for posterity's annals by a giant like Parks. Two, blind gamblers in the dark could see how remote odds were that any shrewd media executive would greenlight so chicken shit a tactic. Word would spread like wildfire, and it'd be universally perceived as desperate, not a power play. Keith knew that. His magazine's editrix apparently did not. Aw, the poor thing's choking on envy right now, isn't she? I spat, consciously watching my volume as others' workspaces were close by. Is your editor jealous that our picture's going to be hanging on museum walls in 100 years? My taunts turned into snarls. You tell that bitch that if she keeps tripping, we'll throw a goddamn press conference on the steps of Vibe's building and call her raggedy ass out by name for being the sore fucking loser that she is. Please tell her that here. Calm down, Keith finally interjected. Let me find out what's going on. Stay by your phone. Click. About 20 minutes later, it rang. Hello. It was Keith. Everything's fine, he said. It is? It is. You sure? I promise. A deep sigh. Thank you, Keith. Thank you. I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. He chuckles. I know you do. Good luck with your thing. And Sheena, yes? Congratulations. Click. Confirmations continued to fly into No Screaming. Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, Marley Marl, UTFO, Nikki D, Saphir, Nice and Smooth, Jermaine Dupri, D-Nice, MC Shan, Chuck Chillout, Naughty by Nature, Freddie Fox, The Jungle Brothers, The Beatnuts, Queen Penn, Poor Righteous Teachers, Channel Live, Shaheem, DJ Hollywood, Crisscross, Paula Perry, Awesome 2 Special K and Teddy Ted, Black Moon, The Locks, Jane Blaze, Shaq, Kid Capri. One early August afternoon, about a month and a half ahead of the big day, Leslie marched into our weekly update working lunch with a magazine tightly coiled into the crook of her arm and a beaming Biff in step behind her. The pair said nothing, stopped above where I sat, and peered down at my curious upturned face. Leslie opened the zine. It was Vibe's September Juice issue, Will Smith's handsome mug atop it, bearing an inquisitive expression. She flipped through its colorful 300-plus pages before locating a 2-page layout. Then, with a dramatic flourish, dropped the open spread under the table in front of me. Vibe had gathered the rappers who participated in 2 ensemble recordings, 1988's Self-Destruction and 1990's We're All in the Same Gang, a list that included Chuck D, Digital Underground Shock G, Big Daddy Kane, MC Light, and MC Hammer. The group photo, visually styled after Kane's famous photo, was taken on Morehouse College's campus in Atlanta. Its title, A Great Day in Hip Hop. I looked up at Biff and Leslie, our respective side eyes locking. The three of us burst into laughter. Postscript. The events of that late September afternoon in 1998 were lovingly revisited by Harry Allen and Miles Marshall Lewis for XXL in dual cover pieces for its December 1998 issue, and recalled since by Michael Gonzalez in articles for Red Bull Music Academy and Ambrosia for Heads. Nelson George's 1999 documentary short, A Great Day in Hip Hop, captured the proceedings superbly, albeit too briefly. Be assured, as anyone who attended or participated will attest, it was as extraordinary as you can imagine. On August 3rd, 1999, less than a year after XXL's A Great Day in Hip Hop, Leslie Pitts died of a pulmonary aneurysm. She was 33. On August 19th, 1999, Los Angeles photographer Arnold Turner gathered dozens of California hip-hop heavyweights under a freeway overpass for A Day in the West. No picture from that shoot was ever released. In 2003, John Grooms, with Kimmy Dennings, shot A Great Day in Atlanta, memorializing the city's rap icons and scene makers at Clark Atlanta University. 2 years later, as part of filming for its My Block series, MTV did the same at the Gilbert House. Hundreds of musicians and creatives in other cities, national and international, have staged their own Great Day homage photo shoots. In June of 2018, photographer Kwaku Alston shot a mix of talented Black actors, directors, and producers for Netflix's A Great Day in Hollywood at the famous Harlem Address. Gordon Parks died on March 7, 2006, of liver cancer. He was 93.